You're listening to Giro Vagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Francavilla al mare.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine. Non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine. Non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Giulia,
qual è il problema?
Se arrivano a 40-50 all'ora,
sì, tutti vogliono stare avanti. Quando arrivano e crea, cioè, confusione.
Pure perché poi c'è la strettoia, c'è il viale, quindi di qua bisogna rallentare per forza.
Sì, sì, sì.
Ma quello che arriva.
Buonasera, Brian Chin Chin from Francavilla al Mare. We were in Francavilla al Mare a couple of hours ago. What you heard this evening in the intro to tonight's podcast was, in fact, me at the roadside, Brian, about 4 kilometers from the finish, mixing with the locals in Francavilla, who were very excited about the stage arriving in their town, but also very worried at that particular point on the course. I was, as I say, at 4 kilometers ago, there was a sort of U-bend, and one of the gentlemen we heard there, well, he said he had a phobia of blood, and he wasn't looking forward to the peloton sort of all crashing down on that bend, because, as I said, there was some anxiety that's what would happen. I have to also say, you might have been able to hear it in that clip, and there were some fairly well lubricated fans there. We were standing outside a tavern, a local hostelry called the Bull Bar, and I would suggest that some of the locals had spent the whole day in the Bull Bar. And we also heard one of the female fans shout out Forza Italia, which could be a political message, or it could have been an invocation to the home riders at the Giro d'Italia. And indeed, the home riders, or one home rider, made the home fans very happy today. We will hear about that in just a minute. But Brian, we are in Francavilla al Mare, close to the sea. The mare bit means sea. The sea is about 100 meters that way in the direction I'm pointing. But Brian, can you describe the scene for us, please?
Yeah, we just arrived at the ora dell'aperitivo, which is a time of day on any given day. Italians go out for pre-dinner drink, or just a drink in general. It's an integrated part of Italian culture that I've come to like very much myself.
No alcohol for us, Brian. I've got a Crodino here. A bright orange. Oh, you've got a gin and tonic. Okay. Yes, no alcohol for me. Just a modest amount for Brian. Brian, Francavilla al Mare. So today, a lot of people have got pretty confused about the regions, because the Giro d'Italia today bit off a large chunk of Italy. It sort of got its, if you can imagine a dog, it kind of got its jaws around around Italy's ankles, just above the kind of stiletto heel, and took a big bite of Campania, Puglia, Molise, and Abruzzo. 4 regions. Now, Francavilla al Mare is famous in sporting terms, quite famous, modestly famous, Brian, for tennis. There's an ATP tennis tournament that happens here every year, and indeed happened just last week. I think it's only a men's event.
Well, Italy is certainly moving up the ranks of international tennis.
Yes.
With Jonathan Sinner.
Yes, Brian. And talking of Italian regions, have you been following the Camilla Giorgi saga?
So someone who's retired, right?
Yeah, so tomorrow we're arriving in the Marche, and the sort of crown princess of Italian female tennis, certainly in the market, was Camilla Giorgi, and she's kind of gone AWOL, and there is all sorts of speculation about where she is. These cryptic Instagram posts, she's being accused of sort of tax fraud, tax evasion, and it is a bit of a soap opera. But Brian, back to the old cycling.
Okay.
And today we did see stage
11
of the Giro d'Italia. Brian, I was woken this morning, not quite woken, I'd already been out for my run. I got a message very early this morning from a good source at a team telling me that Kian Utebrooks' team, but telling me that Kian Utebrooks, who's wearing the white jersey last night, was out of the Giro d'Italia and wouldn't start. Sure enough, about half an hour later, Visma Lisa Bike announced it on social media.
I think I was still asleep by then.
Well, we were asleep yesterday, Brian, because we also didn't mention the fact that Olav Koy didn't start yesterday. So, Brian, I suggest
they're down to. There's plenty of room in the
bus,
in the Visma Lisebike bus.
There is. But Brian, I suggest. Well, let's commence with today's Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Brian, let's rectify what we didn't mention yesterday. We mentioned Olav Koy not starting yesterday. There were some other DNSs, but I feel as though we can't go too far in time. We probably missed a few yesterday. Let's at least get it right today. Were there any DNSs before we even got to Foiano? What was it called? Foiano Val Fortore.
Well, then the only one I actually took notice of. So that, I mean, this is my part of the bookkeeping, I suppose. Was Kian Uytterbrooks?
There were two others.
Okay, well, help a friend out, please.
Stefano Oldani, also DNS today, and Louis Barret of Arkea B&B Hotels. Just jumping forward, I'm pleased to announce there were no DNFs today at the end of today's stage. But Brian, where were we starting, and how long was the stage?
Yeah, it was a long one, as we certainly also felt in the car. But it was, I think it was a wonderful drive to sort of see the other side of the Apennines and reach the coast again unscathed. So we started in Foiano di Valfortore in Campania, as you mentioned. And we finished in Francavilla al Mare, 207-kilometer long stage.
Yes, Brian, and you mentioned that drive. It really was a beautiful drive, particularly the first half, wasn't it? In the very sort of hilly and green part of Campania, more sort of rural than the part of Campania we saw yesterday.
Less busy.
Yeah, much less busy. And we did pass a lot of Aglianico, particularly Aglianico vineyards on the drive to our hotel last night. But it was a lot more sort of pastoral, the scene today. We went through Molise, as you said, that's the second smallest region in Italy. Famously, infamously, it's said by Italians, it's a kind of insult that it doesn't actually exist. We proved it existed today because we drove through,
not Molise.
We went through it. Brian, was there a breakaway today?
Yes, Daniel, there was a breakaway that had me wondering there for quite a bit, but they got away at 5 kilometers of racing. They never got more than a 3-minute gap. It was a trio, and the riders in that were Thomas Champion of Cofidis and the two of the four remaining Visma Lisebike riders, Tim van Dijk and Eduardo Affini. And they went out there and they stayed out there for a long old time, and they didn't get caught until 35 kilometers to go.
Brian, were there any crashes? Significant crashes. I'll take significant crashes. You don't need to tell me every crash. Or any significant riders that came down?
Yeah, there was a crash at 20 kilometers to go. Felix Großschartner and Kevin Vermaken went down. And then there was also a crash at the sort of second part of the sprinting group of riders who contested for the stage win. And one of the riders down were Fabio Jakobsen of DSM. But he made it across the finish line. So we're all keeping our fingers crossed that he will be there again tomorrow.
Brian, I understand, or I think, that Jakobsen was going off for an X-ray this evening. Hopefully he's okay. I think he hit his chest. Großschartner, I was there at the UAE team bus after the finish, spoke to his direct sportive Machin, and they were not too concerned, but they were still waiting for Felix Großschartner to get back to the bus so they could have a better look at him. Hopefully he's okay. He did finish the stage in last place. Brian, tell me what happened in the last sort of kilometre.
Today was a proper sprint. One thing that caught my eye in that last kilometer was how close to the front Tadej Pogacar was again. And part of that is, as he explained also the other day, was to help Molano, who finished fifth. But today I think he was even more putting himself at risk than he was the other day, because it was quite congested. There were fairly high average speed today, having around 40-47, but there were a lot of fresher riders, seeing that they were just basically sitting on the wheels of each other most of the day, and there were way too many riders up there for me, if I had the pink jersey, to mix it with those animals. But he did. Jonathan Milan got a great lead out again. This time he certainly made the most of it by winning in front of Caden Groves. And a stranger to me, or another rider I've paid that much attention to, Giovanni Lonardi. I believe that once before in this Giro he's been sort of up there. Today he finished third. One of the riders you keep an eye out for, Lawrence Pithy, was fourth. Molano, the rider that Pogacar was doing the lead out for, was fifth. Van Poppel, sixth. Fernando Gaviria, seventh. And Phil Bauhaus in eighth.
Brian, there was a relegation. The rider who actually crossed the line in second place, I believe, was Tim Malia. However, looking at the results now, he's down in 18th.
That's right, because I actually saw earlier on that Giovanni Lonardi was fourth, so that makes sense.
He's down in 89th position.
It was a busy old sprint. I mean, the crash wasn't in the first part of the, or the lead out or the sprint for the line. It was further down. And I think that crash was an accident more than it was positioning or elbows out. But
as this is breaking news, we will get the what the Italians call the Moviola out, the sort of action replay machine, and we'll have a look in time for part two. But before we do that, Brian, any significant changes on general classification? I can see a lot of sort of green arrows and number ones next to pretty much everyone's name, because Kian Uttabrooks was out of the race, but there was no time of any real description gained or lost.
I mean, it didn't change anything in the standings, but Geraint Thomas did finish second in the last intermediate sprint, gaining a couple of seconds, but nothing that made him trade places with Dani Martinez, who's still in second.
And the one classification minor competition or marginal competition in which there was a significant change was Jonathan Milan extending his lead in the Ciclamino jersey competition, the points competition. He now has a huge lead, 229 points he's on, and Caden Groves is on 166 points. And Brian, since we haven't mentioned it for a long time, if indeed at all, in this Giro d'Italia, who's winning the team classification without looking?
Then I have to look away because I looked, trying to be as prepared as possible. But I wouldn't have guessed that. It's Decathlon Giro della Mondiale, and they are leading with 7 minutes to Ineos Grenadiers and Bora Hansgrohe on third. Interestingly enough, UAE Emirates is currently on fourth position. Says a lot about the depth and strength of that team.
More about this golden period that Decathlon Agir d'Ozer La Mondiale are experiencing from their team leader, Ben O'Connor, later in the podcast. But first, Brian, let's hear about, well, the significant news at the start today. Kian Uttabrooks having to leave the race through illness. Let's hear about that from his director sportif, Mark Rafe, who spoke to me and other reporters this morning. And after that, we'll hear from the Little Trek director sportif, Gregory Rast, about another sort of masterclass of sprinting from that team and Jonathan Milan.
Like yesterday at the finish line, he was not completely fit, and that developed into being less, even less fit, more in the hotel, developing a fever, and in the end coming to the conclusion in the late evening that that it was already impossible to take the start today. It was his big goal of the year. He was in a perfect position in GC. He went through the week, the first week on a really good way, stayed out of troubles, being fifth in GC, having the white leaders jersey. We as a team wanted to aim for more. And also with the team, we prepared this race for a long time. He started with having a free roll here, where the focus was mainly in the first place on day result, but also during the first week, it turned out that he was that good that we also already supported him more and more, and especially after the first rest day, that it was really a goal also for us to go for an as good as possible GC with him, and now after the first rest day, the day after that we had to take Olaf out, and again a day later that Kian is out, is a big blow for the team, and also both of the goals that we had afterwards with them are gone, so we have to resettle and then look forward again.
Mark, obviously what you achieved last year takes a lot of kind of mental fortitude, mental strength, and the whole organisation. This is a different kind of mental strength, isn't it? Which is more challenging?
Yeah, of course, but I think that we have been in a situation like this also before. Eh? I think the tour of 21, we finished only with four riders, where we were also winning, I think, four stages in the end. And having still Jonas on the podium, I think that that 2 years ago in the Giro we started with the GC goal, that was also gone after I think 4 or 5 days, and then we also switched the stage results and we won two stages and the mountain jersey. So we have been in a situation like this. Also, the guys prepared themselves for a long time for this Giro, and they're also not here just to continue the race to follow. They are ready, they are prepared, they are physically in a good shape. And we want to fight for the chances that are still there.
Well, Gregory, that looked like a very difficult sprint to manage, know how to play it with that strong headwind. I mean, how close was what we saw to what you planned this morning?
I mean, we know the wind will be a bit less here than it was when we came down to the coast. But then we always get the info that there is a lot of headwind from different sources. But our source, they only measured 6-7 k's an hour, so it's not unbelievable strong, but we knew there will be headwind, and it was quite chaotic. We didn't saw too much in the television, but I think the guys managed well, very well.
I think it was a bit stronger than 6 kilometers an hour by the looks of things.
Yeah, I mean, this is the tool who measure it, and it says 6 k's an hour. So they say okay, the flex on the top was quite moving, but on the floor where they're sprinting was quite okay. So we always had it also this in the mind, and it was our main head of performance guy who measured it, so we believed in him. And of course it was not a sprint you should go out from 400 meter anyway.
Yeah. Gregory, on this Giro, I mean, the team has committed whenever there has been an opportunity, really committed, and this seems to be more of a sort of part of your DNA as a team, that you are one of the teams that are very sort of decisive. When you want to go for the stage, then you really go all in. Would you agree with that?
Yes, 100%. I think we have Juan Pedro Lopez here, who won Tour des Alpes, but he knew when he come here he will not have a lot of support for climbing, because we put the main guys for the sprint. And I think this is a decision you need to make, and we did, and we are really, really committed for the sprint days. I think we did all our homework in all the sprint stages, and we missed one opportunity in Lucca. But I think there, it was a pity. But I mean, yeah, the group is full committed. They believe 100% in Johnny, and we believe 100% in the guys. They're doing the, let's say, the dirty work, not the big fame. But that's the reason why Emmanuel is here. He pulled the whole day today. It's impressive. And the rest of the guys, they're always doing their maximum they can. And of course, it's not always working out perfect, but they are all committed.
He looks like, at the moment, well, the sky's the limit for Jonathan. I mean, he looks the fastest rider here by a long way. I mean, how far can he go as a sprinter?
I think he has really no limit. I think you said it right. It's completely... Also, it's not that I know him from 100 years ago. I know him only really this year, but I noticed him like 2 years ago, and the team as well. And, I mean... The things he's doing, it's quite unreal, the sprints especially. But I think also future classic rider, time trialist, this is all really close at the moment.
Great. Thanks a lot, Adam.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP, cycling apparel.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Well, Brian, we heard from two direct sportifs just before the break there. Mark Reef talking about Jumbo Visma Lisa bike. I heard an Italian podcast called them Rabobank yesterday, which probably didn't go down too well at corporate HQ. Talking about how they now need to pivot and they now need to come up with a plan B, something they've done, of course, in the past.
I think we're further down the alphabet here, Daniel.
Excuse me? Oh, well, yeah. They've done it very successfully, of course. They did it, and Mark Reef talked there about the Tour de France, of course, that Jonas Vingegaard, well, he finished second in, didn't he, when Primoz Roglic crashed out. Which year was that? 2021. And there have been other occasions. This isn't a team that has been sort of kissed by good fortune throughout its history. And we saw today, didn't we, them being very aggressive with Tim van Dijk and Eduardo Affini.
I just don't think it made that much sense when you think of what type of stage it was.
Could it maybe have made sense purely from a motive, purely from the, in the sense of sort of getting back on the front foot and being proactive? You might say, well, it would have been more sensible to just recover and use today as a recovery day.
Tomorrow is a real attacker stage. Interestingly enough, Daniel, the new UCI teams ranking came out today. You know, they published that sort of mid Grand Tour. So without looking, how many places do you think Team Visma Lisebike have dropped?
Since when? Or since the last one?
Yeah.
Five?
Oh, three. They are now the fifth best team in the points ranking. They've been passed by Alpecin de Koenig, Lidl Trek, and you know who's second? Very interestingly.
Decathlon?
Exactly. What?
Yeah. Visma Lisebike, I'm sure, will rise again, though. Brian, and in this Giro d'Italia, I think they've got enough firepower left in the team, only four riders, of course, to still not go home empty-handed. That would be my guess. Anyway, but the opportunities are going to be few and far between. I mentioned my conversation with Machin of UAE Team Emirates, and we talked yesterday about the sort of polemica that arose from yesterday's stage. Tadej Pogacar sort of kind of sarcastically saying, well, now everyone's happy because, you know, we gave them the opportunity to win yesterday's stage in a breakaway. And I asked Machin, you know, what kind of pressure have they been under from other teams? Has it been direct? Have they sort of been directly confronted by other teams and riders and told that they're out of order and that they need to give more opportunities?
I certainly hope not. Ooh. For whom the bells toll.
He said that wasn't the case, Brian. They've had no cease and desist letters from any other teams, just sort of slipped under the door of the team bus. But he did say that there aren't that many opportunities left for teams that have come here with mainly sort of breakaway victories on their mind. You might say, well, that's their fault, isn't it? They should have.
Opportunities are to be taken, not given.
Yeah,
in cycling.
But he did also say that yesterday's stage was one of the most unpredictable and difficult to read and sort of manage that he can remember in a Grand Tour. Brian, you're looking at me quizzically. That's what he said.
Yeah, I mean he's done a few, so
yeah.
I just don't think that makes any sense. But good on him if that's how it felt.
Yes.
I've learned to not disagree with everyone.
Well, I mean, this might, Brian, this might shed some light on why Visma Lisebike took the approach they did today. I think it was pretty certain, fairly predictable, that Lidl Trek we're going to ride for a sprint today, as were Alpecin, because the opportunities are going to be fairly few and far between for the sprinters as well between now and Rome. But let's talk about the sprint, shall we? And let's talk about Jonathan Milan. He's emerging as the dominant sprinter of this Giro d'Italia, would you say, Brian, now?
Yes. And he certainly has a very good team helping him. He's not exactly been shoehorned into that role, but changing to Lidl Trek has done a lot of good things for his career so far.
I don't think they were perfect today, though.
No, but I think the mark of a great sprinter is also that even with a less than perfect lead out, the one thing that always puzzles me with how he sprints is that he's able to keep his line.
Unlike Tim Malia,
as we've found out later, that Jonathan Milan, maybe it's his his track experience, or also because of how he's built? You know, once he starts to create turbulence, it would be like a Abdul Jabbar of sorts. But he really keeps a very straight line for how much he's moving around on the bike. And he even talked today in the press conference about how he's trying to avoid breaking the wind for other riders, and that sometimes will mean that he'll need to start his sprint a little unconventionally, which I thought was interesting. And he is also, it's also good for the Italian media. They obviously have Antonio Tiberi to look out for now, even more so now with Wouter Brooks out. But they are, you know, longing for the next big thing constantly. And maybe that is Jonathan Milan in the bunch sprints.
Brian, you talk about him, well, breaking the wind, not breaking wind, that's something else. Breaking the wind. And yesterday we talked about how Olaf Koy had used Milan and used Milan's slipstream very effectively. And we said that this was one of the great perils of the way that Jonathan Milan sprints, and certainly how he sprinted that day in Napoli. One thing I have noticed, they don't employ a sweeper, do they? And not too many. It's not that common that we see that role, or we see a team using a rider for that role. Just to explain what I mean by that, putting a rider behind the sprinter on his wheel to prevent an opponent getting onto that wheel.
It might not be a bad idea.
It might not be a bad idea, but it does mean that you need an extra guy. And I guess it's also quite a specialist role.
Yeah.
And it's probably quite a difficult one. I mean, it's no point putting, you know, Juanpe Lopez there, is it? He's not going to be very effective, I would suggest.
No, I mean, usually it's also someone who's there is because they can't quite do the lead out, and then they're maybe even less likely to be there. So it's kind of a weird role. Probably a bit like my role on the podcast, to be honest. You know, it's just like try to fit in wherever it works.
Brian, Jonathan Milan, you've been attending his press conferences. Well, he's done two now as a stage winner. What do you make of the chap?
I like him as a rider. I think, you know, all the super sprinters, and I think he's moving into that category slowly and surely. But they all have very different characters, and they all have very big personalities. But I find with Jonathan Milan, he's certainly very humble, and he's very thankful towards his team. But I sort of see the difference between now and the first stage that he won. He's a bit more, he's quite eloquent, I find, in Italian, and he's quite good at explaining how the inner workings of the sprints are, and he gets a lot out of the questions asked. He's able to add good insight. It's, I think he's also, it's a bit of a reflection of how well Lidl Trek are doing in general. They're widening their team and places. I think they really worked out how things are supposed to be done, even when their biggest names aren't here, being, for instance, Matt Peterson or Joe Gegenhardt.
I mean, I spoke in the interview with Gregory Rast about this, or I asked him about this, but I've spoken about it before on the podcast, indeed during the Studio d'Italia as well. They impress me with their clarity of thought and execution often as well. And I've said that I think a lot of this has come from Mads Pedersen, just knowing the way he operates and knowing the way he carries himself and knowing the way he leads the team when he is at races. Of course, he's not at this race, but I see a lot of that even in the way they're sort of approaching this Giro d'Italia.
Also, when they take responsibility, they do it wholeheartedly. They don't really faff around much. And we came into this Giro and could barely keep count of how many sprinters there were. But I think they are the team that really invests in getting those stage wins. And it, as often happens, once you get the first one, the second one seems, at least from the outside, or certainly also felt like that from the inside when I've experienced it, comes a little bit easier.
That clarity of thought, Brian, it's also manifested and evident in team selection. And it was a big commitment to bring Milan, Consonni, Turns, Sturven, And there are other riders as well in that team who have contributed. I mean, we heard Ras there talk about Juanpe Lopez actually contributing, Gebre Xavier also, and indeed the other members of that team. Whereas I just want to contrast that, maybe this is a bit unfair, but one team who today I thought got it wrong and got their timings wrong and they misjudged maybe the win was Jayco Alula. Max Valshard was on the front much too early, and then we saw Mezgech looking over his shoulder, couldn't find Caleb Ewan, and Ewan, he sort of got, well, lost in the deep blue sea of the peloton in the last 500 meters, and it certainly hasn't clicked for them yet. They didn't commit so wholeheartedly to Ewan with their team selection, did they?
No. It's hard, isn't it, when you want to do something significant, you want to be very visible in all three Grand Tours, and it's almost impossible. Even you see now with this is the fourth Grand Tour for Jumbo-Visma, where they won a stage, and it might actually be the only thing they'll take with them from here. So what difference does a year make? But I think the overall landscape of sprinters is ever changing, and I think the one big difference is really how the teams work around them, the sprinters, and not so much the actual top speed of one individual or the other. I might be wrong, but that's what it looks like to me.
Brian, I'm just checking Jayco Alula, double checking Jayco Alula's team here, so I don't do them a disservice. I mean, they brought Mezgech, obviously, as the main lead-out man. Valshard as well. Well, he was second last today, and he's a very powerful... Well, he's a sprinter, has been a sprinter in his own right, a real asset in a lead-out train. And they've also got Hepburn, who has done a job in lead-out trains for many, many years. Luke Plapp as well pitches in. So... Ewan isn't being neglected. I'll make a point to have a chat with him tomorrow, see how his Giro d'Italia is going. We haven't heard from him so far, and it's obviously a big year for him, going back to where it all started at, well, the team formerly known as Green Edge, and he's shown flickers of his former self, but it's not clicking. Hasn't clicked at this Giro d'Italia as yet. Brian, we talked about Lidl Trek and committing to an objective. One team, another team that is also showing the value of that at this Giro d'Italia and indeed throughout 2024 has been Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale. Yesterday, we got some good insight. I thought some really good insight from Lucky Larry about how he's approaching this Giro and also how he's had a bit of an epiphany in the sense that he has been a breakaway hunter in the past, and that means being very active in the first hour of stages. And I thought it was really interesting as well what Larry said about sort of going to bed at night having not made the breakaway and the sort of stress that that can bring to bear on a rider, and that can also affect their physiology. It can affect their whole experience of a Grand Tour, and Larry's feeling very fresh. We're building Larry up. I mean, tomorrow's stage 12. Joe Dombrowski before the Giro said that this was Larry's stage. I don't think it is Larry's stage, because I don't think it's part of AG2R's
grand plan
for Larry to get in a break, but who knows. But Brian, that was Larry also talking about clarity of focus. He's talked about that with us since the start of the year. There has been a pivot from Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale. Of course, their team leader, Ben O'Connor, is currently in fourth place on general classification, in pretty good shape. He is, let me just see, 3 minutes, 39 seconds adrift of Tadej Pogacar. And I just thought, Brian, that it would be interesting to hear from him this morning about what he thinks the secret of this fantastic year that his team are having is. Here's Ben O'Connor.
How very enterprising, considerate of you. Ben, well, how are you doing, first of all?
Good, yeah. Ready for today, nice sunny one. And hopefully it should be chill, more or less.
Interesting you mentioned being chill. Larry, who tells absolutely everything about what's going on in the team.
Yeah.
He doesn't give away any classified information. He talks about the rest day, and we were talking about southern Italy, and I said it's not a place for introverts, that they, you know, people who get overstimulated easily. And he said, oh, Ben, it's probably not for Ben. You're sort of suggesting you're a bit of an introvert.
No, I wouldn't say I'm introverted. I just don't think I like kind of a messy style. I don't really love chaos. And I much prefer to be, you know, for example, if I'm going to visit somewhere, Copenhagen or the Dolomites, places like this, you know, they're beautiful, they're clean, and I think they're appealing like that, whilst the kind of like ruggedness of Napoli the kind of chaotic blend of kind of dark and shittiness with character. It can be fun, but it's not really my kind of style.
And we'll move on, Ben. just obviously yesterday, another brilliant day in this incredible, incredible year that the team's having. You know, so much talk about the bikes. Talk about the way the team's changed strategy as well. You're being much more kind of systematic about targeting goals. I mean, if you had to name two or three things, what would be the main factors that you would mention?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think we've been a lot clearer with not just our preparation, but the targets throughout the race. You know, yesterday was very clear. It was Aurelien and Valentine for the breakaway. It was those two specifically. And they haven't had the role to be in a breakaway any other day so far throughout this race. You can look at Larry as well as an example of a guy who normally would probably come to the Giro and just try and fight for breakaways. But when you have someone like me here as well, it's obviously extremely clear that you have a guy who's good, trying to fight with top five best guys in the race. So he's very clearly got his role to look after me and guard. But his opportunity will come later in the race as well. So I think by doing that, you're firing less like critical bullets, because to make the breakaway, often you really do have to fire bullets. And it's the reason why I think a lot of these guys can have terrible days. You know, DeMarkey and Clark, they can pull the pin, but I'm pretty sure that they feel pretty rough after trying for the breakaway, because you really do have to have a bit of an exceptional day to get the win. And I think that's probably where our team's changed its main kind of approach.
Interesting thoughts there from Ben O'Connor. Just talking about Valentin Paris-Peintre's stage win yesterday. I didn't get a massage from Larry late last night. I got a message from him. He sent me a few random Paris-Peintre facts. I think one of them I put on Twitter. He might be small, but he has a really big personality, and in the bunch, he doesn't take shit from anyone, says Larry. Look out for VPP. He and his brother are super competitive with each other, and are always shit talking each other, which is funny. Larry needs to clean up his language. And three, none of the team's casual clothes fit him, so they have to order the kids' sizes. a big rider, a big talent in a small package, Valentin Paris-Peintre. And like some of the other riders who have taken victories in breakaways in this Giro d'Italia, I wouldn't rule out a second one for Valentin Paris-Peintre, because there will be opportunities. Brian, spoke to a lot of riders this morning at the start. I gave you a choice, multiple choice, for today's Chiacchierata del Giorno. There were two good candidates. We're going to play one today and we'll save one for tomorrow. Two of the more senior riders in the bunch. Michael Valgren is one. EF Education First, Easy Posts. Michael Valgren, of course, narrowly missed out on victory in Lucca about a week ago. We'll hear from him tomorrow. But today, Brian, we're going to hear from a Swifty. Not Taylor Swift, not Connor Swift, who's also here, but Ben Swift.
He's been around longer than Taylor.
I'm trying to think. When Taylor Swift's first album, I think, was 2007. And
it's quite interesting how Ben Swift, fast you are.
Yeah, Ben Swift's his debut season was with Barloworld in 2007. No, he was a stagiaire then. So, in fact, Taylor Swift did turn pro before Ben Swift. And I think Ben Swift did the Giro d'Italia. He did his first Giro d'Italia, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, Barloworld threw everyone in for the Lions, didn't they?
But he did his first Giro d'Italia for Katusha in 2009.
Oh, yeah. You know how I remember that? I worked for Sky when they tried to dismantle his contract with Katusha and had to pay a significant amount of money to André Schmil, the manager of the time.
Caused a lot of beef, that did, didn't it?
Did too.
If I'm not mistaken as well, in that Giro d'Italia, or certainly that year anyway, when he was with Katusha, he was rooming on occasion with Pippo Pozzato, the peacock of Sanrigo. Anyway, Ben Swift has been around for a long time, and he's going to be around for a bit longer, as he confirmed to me this morning.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Well, Ben, I spoke to you about a week ago in Liguria. Oh, there's a question for you. You who have lived in Italy, today we visit four regions. Can you name them? Four regions. It might
four
be a record.
Regions.
Yeah.
Let's go. Abruzzo.
Yeah, that's one of them. One of them. Not the first. That's the last.
That's the last one.
It's a nasty question, this is.
It is. No, not a clue.
Okay. We're in Campania, then we go into Puglia. Well, you go into Puglia for 10 kilometres, then Molise, and then Abruzzo.
I want to know that. And I know the north of one's spot.
Well, a week ago, Ben, you were in good spirits and the team was riding well, particularly the way you're positioning Geraint and so on. And that's continued, hasn't it? I guess you guys must be pretty happy with the way things are going on that front.
No, definitely. I think, you know, it's quite the identity of this team, really. We do that quite well, and especially when we've got quite a few experienced riders, you know, I ride quite well with Geraint, and then you've got the other guys in the mix that are on the very same wavelength as well. You know, you don't really need to speak too much about it. Everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody's super committed, and we're having fun on the bike as well, so I think that also translates into the way that we're riding.
Geraint, after the Napoli stage, he said, oh, I'm looking forward to next year when I won't be here and I'll be watching the guys do this. You are, in theory, still going to be around next year. How are you currently feeling about that?
No, I'm happy. I mean, Geraint's still going to be here. I just don't think he's going to be at the Giro, is he? So, no, I mean, it's kind of strange, you know. I think maybe we touched on it last week, was like, it used to be that you come into cycling and you have to find your feet, progress a little bit, you get the odd little result here and there, but and then you get into like your mid-20s, very early 30s, they'd be your prime years, and then after 33 you'd kind of be hanging on, retiring or just kind of making up the numbers. But now we're seeing a shift in cycling. I think it's just the way that the sport's become much more professional, the training, the nutrition, the attention to detail, the investment in across like multiple teams. It's lifted the bar, and you've seen guys now, obviously Geraint's coming, what's he going to be, 38 at the end of this next week, performing at the highest level. He's still pushing for the podium there, pushing for the win. And myself, okay, I don't challenge for as much personal results anymore, but I would say overall and consistently I'm perhaps the best version of myself that I've ever been in that terms, you know. But I still enjoy it. I still enjoy the training and the racing. And but it's not only us that are performing at a high age. You know, Stacker Langen's doing a fantastic job at an old age.
Is he old? How old is he?
Well, he's the oldest in his team anyway.
You might be doing a disservice there.
No, he's around me. He's around my sort of age. Maybe not quite as old. Two years younger, but he's old.
I remember, Ben, when you turned professional, you're obviously the generation of Geraint and Mark Cavendish, and Mark used to say that Ben didn't necessarily have a big engine. I don't know whether I'm just doing you a disservice here. I don't know how your test results used to be back in the days. Obviously now a lot of riders are selected on the basis of numbers, and you know, Swift even, there are various riders in the peloton. Do you ever think that you would have struggled to turn professional if you were trying now?
Yeah, I think it's a very different sport now. I think the way that I turned professional, I think the way as with Cav as well, we were very race smart and craft smart and always in the mix. We were never the ones that were producing the power. We know it's quite well known that I never actually made it onto the talent team when that first came about, because it was just power tests. I was the only guy that wasn't on it from my category, but then I would still win the races. So it's like, it's not all about power, but that's also, you know, I spoke a little bit with Cav on this topic. It's like we're getting a lot of these guys coming through that they're so strong and so powerful, like in terms of Swift and stuff, but they just haven't got the racecraft. So it's like they've got the engine to be there, but they're not necessarily got the skills and know where to position and what side of the wheel. And I think that's a little bit why the peloton is becoming, I don't know if it's becoming more dangerous. It's always had that element of danger. The thing is, there's more people able to still be there in the demanding finals and the demanding points of the race, you know. So the level is gone up, but definitely we're perhaps one of the only sports where you can just do a good potential number and then get put in the pro ranks, where other sports you've kind of got to get licenses and progress and prove yourself. And I think there's something in still doing like the under 23 category, really, if I'm honest, because you learn so much and you develop your race skills and stuff like that.
Well, Brian, the clouds are gathering over our heads. The temperature is falling. The weather is supposed to, unfortunately, deteriorate over the next few days. Not too significantly, if the application that I use is correct. Certainly over the next 3 or 4 days. Beyond the weekend, I'm not quite sure. Brian looks worried.
No, I don't worry. I brought a rain jacket, but we already heard that the Stelvio pass cannot be passed by the Giro.
Another thing we didn't announce yesterday that we should have done.
Yes. I'm thinking more about the riders, because there is, even without Stelvio, quite a bit of altitude in the coming stages, and it gets mighty cold up there if the weather is what I could read out of your eyebrows.
Hopefully we're going to have altitude and attitude over the next 10 days of the Giro d'Italia, because it's going to take a lot of attitude and legs and bravery to challenge Tadej Pogacar, who's looking very serene, back in his Ciclamino shorts today, which have been cleared by the UCI now. No threat of him being kicked out of the race. Brian, the team buses this morning, as we said earlier, we were in a remote part of Italy, and the team buses had quite a mazy route to the finish, which meant that they had to leave before the start of the stage, and they sort of decanted all of their riders out onto the start line, and the likes of Pogacar were really just sort of mincing about for half an hour, didn't have a whole lot to do, sort of sitting on the tarmac shooting the breeze.
Very small village where the start was today.
But he did look extremely relaxed. There's been some talk tonight, more and more people picking up on this little sort of sniffle that he's got. He sounds a little bit bunged up. He's been telling us that it's only allergies. Of course, that the virus that has accounted for and taken Olaf Kooi out of the race, Kian Uttabroeks out of the race, that's probably causing some alarm in some teams, but nothing to suggest that Pogacar is going to be its next victim. We certainly hope not. Brian, another important, exciting-looking stage coming tomorrow. Let's find out more about it, shall we?
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, last night's dinner, we were staying in a lovely masseria, they call them in the south of Italy, in Puglia, and also in Campania you get that word as well, like an old farmhouse, effectively.
It's really their word for an agriturismo.
Yeah. Sort of serve up a lot of their own products.
And proudly so.
We had some nice Aglianico wine, some very kind of beefy, dense red wine. As I said yesterday, we saw a lot of that being grown either side of the road when we headed to our hotel last night. What did we have for dinner? Oh, we had an absolutely era-defining bowl of spaghetti al pomodoro, didn't we? Tomato, just very simple tomato sauce with spaghetti. We talked in last night's podcast about the Gragnano pasta. I'm not sure if it was Gragnano pasta, but it was certainly very good pasta.
Yeah, cooked to perfection. I did the mistake of doing la scarpetta, which is when you break off a piece of bread and just get the last bit of sauce. And I hope I'm not going to be like crucified for this, but I don't eat garlic. And there was a piece of garlic on my scarpetta, and then I had to drink a limoncello to get the taste out of my mouth.
The podcast Dracula. Well, Brian, you've earned yourself a rest on La Tappa di Domani. You are the gentleman who usually presents that for us. Today I roped in someone else, Brian, bearing in mind that tomorrow we're going to Le Marche, a new region of Italy for us on this Giro d'Italia. I thought I would get one of the pelotons, I'm not sure if he's the only marchegiano in the peloton, but one of the riders from that region, to present the stage for us. It was in Italian, and the rider was Giulio Pellizzari, the 20-year-old from San Severino Marche. He rides for VF Group Bardiani, and as it is in Italian, was in Italian, I will live dub, live translate for us, Brian.
Beh, parte da Martinsicuro, arrivo a Fano, i primi 60-50 chilometri sono tendenzialmente piatti, poi...
So Brian, Giulio, Mr. Pellizzari told us to stay, starts from Martinsicuro, arrives in Fano. First 60 kilometers generally flat, then it starts with a series of classic Marche walls, the kind of roads we see in the Tirreno Adriatico. The route then passes through Recanati, Osimo, then heads towards Fano. The finish is flat, but it's quite challenging. He said they're short walls, short climbs, maybe less than 2 or 3 kilometers, some of them, but they're generally over 10% in gradient. Some of them are quite wide, but they're short and intense.
A lot of up and down.
Yes. He says he hopes he'll have a lot of support tomorrow. A gentleman is trying to sell us a necklace. Giulio Pellizzari says he hopes he'll have a lot of support tomorrow. Wasn't quite sure where they would be, or if indeed they would bother turning up. We hope so, certainly, for his sake. And he thinks that tomorrow a breakaway will make it. Asked him for a prediction. He couldn't give me one.
Can I just say, Daniel, that one, the last of those walls, the Montegiove, it's tops out at 13 kilometers before the finish. It has an average gradient of 9.2%. Breakaway.
How long
not,
is it, bro?
It's just a kilometer and speedually, like 1.2. But there will be some GC action there. I think that's unavoidable. I think any move will be covered by Pogacar, potentially countered. And if there is a breakaway, I think that decisive move for the win could happen exactly there.
Finally, Brian, I asked Giulio Pellizzari where would he stop or where would he advise a spectator to stop and have a nice picnic or a nice lunch and watch the stage. He said Recanati has a particularly beautiful view and that would be a good spot to spend your day if you're going to the race tomorrow. Incidentally, Brian, I did notice that Giulio Pellizzari came in second last today, 154th, didn't speak to him after the finish, but that could be an indicator A, that he's not feeling too well, or B, that he's saving himself for that home stage tomorrow. So look out for him. Brian, another feature of tomorrow's stage, and just see how well I can shoehorn this in, shall we?
Good luck.
A couple of days ago, on the 9th of May, in fact, it was the anniversary. How many years was it? Let me think. 1978, Brian. How many years is that? 46 years. 46 years, if I'm not mistaken. 46 years. Since what Italians often refer to as their 9/11. One of the defining moments, defining tragedies, defining news stories of the 20th century. And that was the death, the murder... Well, first kidnap, then murder of the politician Aldo Moro. Now, Brian, why am I mentioning this today now? Because I intended to mention it originally on the 9th, which was the anniversary, unfortunately, of Aldo Moro's body being discovered in the back of a car. Also, second tenuous reason why I can mention it today, we did go through Puglia today. Aldo Moro was from Puglia. Thirdly, and fans of the neutralized zone in Grand Tour stages, pay attention now. Tomorrow, on tomorrow's stage, in the neutralized zone, the peloton goes along the Via Aldo Moro in Martinsicuro.
It's an Aldo, Via Aldo Moro in...
Well, we'll whisper it, Brian. We won't tell the listeners it's a Via Aldo Moro in pretty much every town in Italy. And we'll pretend that this is, you know, an incredible sort of series of events conspiring to mean that we, you know, it was only correct to talk about the death of Aldo Moro and the murder of Aldo Moro this evening. I kind of have. But Brian, I thought we should hear a little bit more about this from our good friend, Professor of Modern Italian Studies at the University of Bristol, John Foote. So here he is to tell us, who was Aldo Moro?
Aldo Moro had been prime minister many times, a Christian Democrat, a kind of moderate. He was very important because he wanted to have an alliance between the Christian Democrats and the left, firstly with the Socialist Party, who were kind of more moderate. And then he was trying to build an alliance with the Communist Party, which was a huge organization, which is a very difficult, controversial things, the Cold War. So he, that was his kind of mission. And he, in 1978, he on the 16th of March, he was driving with his bodyguards and driver to Parliament, where this was his kind of dream was going to be installed. There was going to be a government of the Christian Democrats supported by the communists for the first time. And as he's driving towards Parliament, he's attacked by the biggest left-wing terrorist group, the most powerful left-wing terrorist group in Italy at that time, called the Brigate Rossa, the Red Brigades. They kill all five members of his drivers and his bodyguards in 2 minutes, take him out of the car, kidnap him and hold him in Rome for 55 days. And an extraordinary dramatic moment. It's world news. It's on the front cover of Time, front cover of Newsweek. I mean, this is something extraordinary. In the end, this is a very long story, I won't go into detail, but in the end, the negotiations, as there aren't really any negotiations, there are kind of some negotiations, but he's murdered by the Red Brigades, left in a car in the centre of Rome, and it's a kind of extraordinary operation, which is still causing a kind of trauma today to Italy. It's a kind of traumatic moment, the discovery of the body in the back of this red car, very near to the head offices of the Christian Democrats and the Communist Party. It's a kind of what you call in Italy a beffa, a kind of taking the mickey.
Brian, there have been some excellent documentaries about Aldo Moro. Exterior Night, a film directed by Marco Bellocchio, released in 2023, if I'm not mistaken. That's worth a watch, certainly. And I did look back. I was kind of curious, Brian, bearing in mind that this happened mid-Giro d'Italia, so about days into the 1978 Giro d'Italia, which was won by Johan de Munck, the last Belgian Grand Tour victory. The Giro d'Italia was in Tuscany, and on the day after Aldo Moro's body was discovered, they were climbing Monte Serra, which is a very famous climb in Tuscany. And I did read the reports in L'Unità, which was the Communist Party's newspaper, effectively, and their front page talked about the day that Italy stood still. And there was a moment's silence, and likes of Felice Gimondi were quoted saying that the country has to stay united and we all have to react firmly. But the Giro, it did go on. Again, the report in L'Unità talked about this mood, this national mood of total sort of despair and mourning and shock.
The troubles weren't over. I mean, maybe some of our listeners are well aware of this, but Italy did go through a very tough time from the late 60s to the late 80s. A lot of, I don't know if you call it domestic terrorism, but terrorist attacks on from groups from both sides of the political spectrum. And even in today's modern Italy, I think because it's actually not that long ago, I think a lot of the people of age of my parents maybe who live here, it still contributes to a big trauma of their life. You know, we imagine something like that would happen today, that one of the most significant politicians were captured and kidnapped 55 days and then
found
shot
in the boot of a car.
Yeah.
Brian, Giro d'Italia resumes tomorrow. We will be in Le Marche, a really, really beautiful region of Italy. I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to an exciting stage. And we will be back tomorrow from Fano. Buonasera.
Buonasera domani.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.